This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Do you want $3 of your federal tax to go to the Presidential Election Campaign Fund? The IRS asks each of us that question every year when we fill out our tax return, and more of us are saying no. The money from the 11% who say yes goes to fund the campaigns of qualified presidential candidates, but they do not have to accept that money or the restrictions that go with it. This year, three major candidates have opted out. President Bush, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, and most recently Senator John Kerry. Is public financing now effectively dead? Later in the program, we'll go to London to talk about the mechanics of a state visit. President Bush is currently on his way to Buckingham Palace, where he'll stay as the guest of the Queen. But first, the history and the questionable future of public campaign financing. In a few minutes, Congressman Marty Meehan and Senator Mitch McConnell will join us with views from both sides of the aisle in Congress. We want to hear from you, of course, as well. If you have questions about the fund and how it works and why candidates would give up $19 million, give us a phone call. How do you want campaigns to be financed? Our numbers here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us now on the phone from Philadelphia is Thomas Mann, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. And good to have you back on the program, Tom.
Happy to be with you, Neil.
First of all, discuss the decisions that were made by President Bush, former Governor Dean, and Senator Kerry to opt out of the system. They each had different reasons, didn't they?
They did indeed. Remember, they each opted out of one part of the public financing system, that applying to the nominating process, which involves matching public funds in response to accepting to live by certain spending limits. But it's very likely that President Bush and whoever ends up being the Democratic nominee will participate in the general election, which involves a full public grant, close to $74 million. So we're talking about the first part of that. George Bush, as a candidate for president in 2000, decided to opt out of the system because he believed he could raise substantially more funds than were permitted to be spent under the law. And in fact, he did that. He raised about $100 million, while the spending limits were more like $43 million. This year, he's decided to repeat that decision to opt out, and it's his ambitions are much higher now because the contribution limit has gone from $1 to $2,000. He has raised his sights from $100 million to anywhere from $170 to $200 million, even though he has no opponent in the nominating process.
So that would effectively mean he gets to run ads all during the primary season and all the way up until the Republican convention.
That's exactly right. The funds that the Bush campaign are raising now will be used for two main purposes. One, to define to the public the Democratic nominee as soon as it's clear who it will be, with a preemptive television ad campaign. And secondly, to begin to build the grassroots machine for getting out the vote on Election Day. Any funds not spent by the campaign at the time of the Republican convention can be transferred to the Republican National Committee and then used for activities permitted by the law, including lots of local voter identification, get out the vote activities.
Now, for former Governor Dean, his decision involved he had initially pledged himself to accept public financing, but then realized if he did get the nomination, he might be vulnerable from the period of the end of the primaries to the Democratic convention.
That's exactly right. The spending limits may strike citizens as high. It's about $45 million in the primary season. But the reality is that serious candidates will expend virtually all of those funds probably by early March, the time at which we expect the nominee to be apparent. Then that candidate is without funds to carry on any kind of a campaign for the many months until the Democratic convention, at which point he would get the public grant for the general election. Also, since the new campaign finance law was passed, the parties are not in the same position as they were in 1996 and 2000 to try to compensate for that shortfall by using so-called soft money to run so-called issue ads that effectively carry the campaign on. So Dean calculated that given his extraordinary success in internet fundraising, that he could raise much more than the $45 million permitted if he had accepted the public match. In fact, he's probably set his sights on $100 million or more, and that it's worth the gamble. Frankly, it also gives him a little more flexibility if his adversaries for the Democratic nomination prove to be more formidable and more dogged than he hopes. He'd be able to spend more. And most importantly, he's free from the state-by-state spending limits. There's an overall spending cap for those who opt into the system, but there's also state limits. And those limits make no sense given the varying importance of states that come early versus those that come late. Mm-hmm. Dean now would be free to spend all he wants in Iowa and New Hampshire, for example.
And Senator Kerry, you say President Bush going for the $2,000 contributions. Howard Dean says he's going for $50 contributions. Senator Kerry is being forced to play a little catch-up here, but he's going for a third track.
Well, that's right. Senator Kerry has suggested that in opting out of the public matching system, he may well draw on personal resources. It turns out that, according to decisions of the Supreme Court, an individual may spend as much of his or her own funds as they want on their own campaign unless they accept the limits associated with the public funding system. Senator Kerry has some wealth, although there are real questions about how much he personally has. He obviously owns some alone and together with his wife, Teresa Hines Kerry, substantial real estate holdings and perhaps some several millions of dollars. But that's not very much given the amount of money we're talking about here. He would not be able to accept unlimited funds from his wife. She's treated as any other contributor. It's only joint funds held, and there's some question about how much is there. I think what would happen is Senator Kerry would take out a loan against property he owns and hopes that it would give him sufficient funds to fight it out with Howard Dean and in New Hampshire. If he's successful, his hope would be that he could then harness the internet as well as other $2,000 donors to raise money needed for the rest of the primary season as well as to compete with President Bush in that down period from March until mm-hmm. the party convention.
Now, briefly, can you remind us, what was it that created this program to have the public finance presidential campaigns? Where did this come from?
Yes, there was an original provision in law in 1971 for public funding, but there was never a financing mechanism set up for it. But then after the scandals of the 1972 Watergate and campaign to reelect President Nixon, the Congress in 1974 passed amendments to the campaign finance law that set up a public funding system for the presidential election. They did this partly growing out of the scandals of a sitting president extorting huge contributions from corporations and individuals. They wanted to eliminate the role of big money in our elections. They wanted to slow the money chase in which presidential candidates spend huge amounts of time seeking those funds. And finally, they wanted to establish some level of equity between the parties so as to have genuinely competitive elections. Those were the motivations in passing the law back in 1974.
Well, joining us now is someone who ran his presidential campaign under the rules of the public financing system. Former Senator Paul Simon of Illinois joins us now from his office in Carbondale. And good to have you back on the program, Senator.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
When you ran on the Democratic for president of the Democratic nomination back in 1988, at that time, if memory serves, it would have been unthinkable to opt out of the system.
That is right. Of course, things have changed a great deal. And you didn't have an opposition candidate. It was unclear who the Republicans' candidate would be at the when I was in the race.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't have anyone who said, I'm not going to abide by the limits. So that's one of the very practical considerations that Howard Dean and John Kerry, as well as the other candidates, have to consider.
Now, were there times when you were running where you said, you know, this is crazy, I wish I'd just opted out of this?
Well, I can't say I did, because I was on the lower end in terms of the amount of money raised. I among the seven candidates I was we had at that point, I was sixth in the amount of money I raised. Now, I did better than that, and I ran better than sixth in Iowa, New Hampshire, and other places, but...
Mm-hmm.
But the money thing has always been a problem, and it's a problem for any candidate who votes against, the insurance companies, some of the defense requests, and other things.
Should this be regarded as a matter of principle, that this is something we ought to do, or should this be open to decision of the candidates and whatever works best for them?
No, we really ought to be changing it. And we have to recognize every reform needs a reform in about 12 years.
And this one's been about 25 years or more.
Yeah, and let me just add a little historical note. Way back when Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton were struggling, and Hamilton said people of wealth and property should be given more voice, and Jefferson said all people should be treated equally. Well, of course, it didn't include women and African Americans and Indian Americans at that point. But when you were in the fourth grade, you were so proud that Jefferson had prevailed. Well, in fact, through our present system of financing campaigns, Alexander Hamilton has prevailed.
Let's get a caller involved. Our number is 800-989-8255, and Mike is on the line with us from Rochester, New York.
Hello, and a terrific topic. Let me start out by saying I'm very glad to hear Senator Simon's voice again. I was really sorry to see that bow tie not travel to the White House.
Thank you.
As I was listening to you discuss this subject, an idea that's been bouncing around in the back of my mind came to the fore, and that is that the American populace itself has little incentive to push for campaign finance reform. I think we have two different points of view about finance reform. A, it's not going to work, which obviously it has not. And B, if it does work, it's going to cut us, as the people who open our wallets for our candidates, off from the influence that we might be able to have upon our candidates.
Mike, let's get a quick response from Senator Simon.
Yes, I would say, first of all, it did work for a while. And so that the idea that it won't work just is not true. And in terms of people having a voice, you have 44 million Americans who don't have health insurance. You have a few special interests that profit from the present system. Those special interests are being heard much, much more powerfully by the candidates than are the 44 million people who don't have health insurance, who are not big campaign contributors.
Senator Simon, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Paul Simon joined us from Illinois, from his office in Carbondale. When we come back from the break, we'll be joined by Congressman Marty Meehan and Senator Mitch McConnell to get their ideas. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the financing of presidential campaigns with taxpayer money. Our guest is Thomas Mann, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And let's get another caller in. And Well, we're having a little difficulty with that phone today. Let's try John, and John's on the line with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Oh, I'm surprised I got on, and I thank you for taking my call. I would particularly like to address your having Senator McConnell on the program,
mm-hmm.
because I feel that he's been one of the really good guys on this issue. And I feel so because I think he's raised issues that our press has really been unwilling to explore. One of my concerns has been that I think that the country badly needs third political parties. I don't see how you can effectively have that without, in fact, having soft money and having no limits on it. And I think if you apply that to third parties, you certainly would have to apply that to the two major parties. I think the trouble with campaign finance reform and the hysteria over it is, in fact, we've made things much worse. I think that what we really need is a big discussion following a repeal of all the laws on finance, campaign finance, that's been passed since Richard Nixon became president.
Mm-hmm.
After 2 years, maybe we could come up with some good ideas to put something workable in place.
Senator McConnell will be on later to speak for himself. Thomas Mann, what about that point, though, on the third parties?
Yeah, I mean, this, of course, the presidential public funding system isn't directly relevant to the issue of soft money. The fact is the public financing system provides an opportunity for third parties to emerge, garnering 5% of the vote, and then having public funds on which to build in subsequent elections. I personally, I mean, it's fine to have third parties emerge. It's not clear to me they are the be-all and end-all of our political system, but I don't think you need large, unlimited contributions from corporations, unions, and wealthy individuals to permit a third party to come forward. As far as the broader issue of whether we should just repeal all the laws, there'd be a certain honesty to it. Before the McCain-Feingold law passed, we made a mockery of the laws on the books by basically ignoring the imperatives of the law. The Supreme Court will rule within the next 3 or 4 weeks on the constitutionality of the law. If they strike it down effectively, they're saying, Congress, you can't regulate in this arena, and we may start from scratch.
Well, let's find out more about that, because Congressman Marty Meehan of Massachusetts is on the line with us now from Capitol Hill, and it's good to have you back on the show.
Neil, pleasure to be on.
And so I assume you're waiting on tenterhooks for that Supreme Court decision. You're also, though, working on legislation right now to overhaul the current public financing system.
Well, at least with regard to the presidential campaign, first of all, on the decision, I expect the decision to be out the first or second week of December, and I think it's going to be a good decision for campaign finance reformers. And I feel very confident that the soft money ban will be upheld by the Supreme Court. But we've been focusing the last few months on the presidential system. It's clear that the president isn't participating in this public financing system, and now there are two Democrats that have opted out. So it's clear that the system is broken and needs to be fixed.
What needs to be done to fix it, in your view?
Well, we have to have an incentive for somebody to participate in the checkoff system. Right now, for example, the president's going to spend somewhere around $200 million on a primary where he is unopposed, and the Democratic candidates, if they were to participate in public financing, would only have $45 million, and they wouldn't basically be able to spend money between the time the nominee is determined, which would likely be around the end of March, until the convention, which conventions are in the end of July, early August. That provides an opportunity for the president, for example, to spend $200 million where the Democratic candidate doesn't have any money because they have already spent all their money in the primary process.
Hmm. Now, we mentioned that tactical disadvantage. How would you fix it?
Well, it's more than a tactical disadvantage. It means that basically you would have $200 million that the president could spend in the time period between April and the end of July, where the Democratic candidate wouldn't have any money and couldn't get money until till they're into the general election. So we need to provide more public funds for primary and general election candidates and raise the spending limits for those candidates. What we also need to do, it seems to me, is make public funds available earlier in the process because of the front-loading of primaries. Basically, the primary system is all front-loaded, so the primary is going to be over by the end of March. So we need to make adjustments for that as well.
One proposal, as I understand it, would raise the checkoff amount to $10. When it went up to $3 from $1, a participation dropped by 4%. Wouldn't a $10 checkoff decrease the numbers even further? It's just 11% who opt for it now.
Well, two things. One is clearly you would have to increase the checkoff. This mechanism isn't expected to raise sufficient resources over the long term. What I think is we should have a voluntary checkoff that would be available if people wanted to give more. In other words, there are people in the country who would give more for a checkoff system. The other thing that's interesting about this is we need to educate people as to what the checkoff is for. For example, in many instances, the software that's used, well, my taxes were prepared by my CPA. He sent me the taxes. I went over them, and I just happened to catch the fact that the checkoff was rejected. I thought maybe people might think it was a little hypocritical for me not to check the checkoff.
Oh, so, they might. They just might.
So I asked him to, I said, why did this happen? He said, well, all this preparation software that we use automatically rejects a checkoff, and we always reject a checkoff because we're looking to find the way that for someone to pay the least amount in taxes. So I said, well, you have to do them over again. You got to check yes for me on this. But as I became aware of it, that's something else we need to do is let people decide if they want to check off or not. Anyone who has an automatic preparer where they use this preparation software, they automatically check off. No to that question. So three things. One is, yes, we're going to have to increase at least up from the $3. We're also going to have to allow a line in the tax forms where people could give more if they wanted to, wealthy individuals, for example, that might want to write a check for $1,000 to it. Final thing would be to prevent tax preparation software from automatically rejecting the checkoff.
Well, Congressman Meehan, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Neil. It's always a pleasure.
Marty Meehan, a Democrat from Massachusetts, spoke with us from Capitol Hill. And joining us now from his office on Capitol Hill is Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky. And thanks very much for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
You're on the record of being against public financing of presidential campaigns. How come?
Well, about 90% of Americans are as well. We have the most complete poll ever taken on any issue at any time every April 15th. When about 90% of Americans choose not to allocate tax money they've already paid, it doesn't add to their bill, choose not to divert $3 away from some worthwhile program to fund the campaign of someone who's with whom they may disagree. They don't want to use tax dollars to pay for attack ads and balloons and bumper strips.
Mm-hmm.
In Congressman Meehan's own state, which is widely known as the most liberal state in America, they recently repealed taxpayer funding of elections at the state level. In my state, we had this ill-fated experiment for a couple of governor's elections, and the legislature just repealed it. I think we can stipulate that taxpayer funding of elections is overwhelmingly unpopular with the American people, and that's why not more of them check off.
Do you think that the decision by three major candidates this time around to opt out of the system effectively means that it's dead?
I hope so. It should have died a long time ago, and I think it's much better for campaigns to be supported by people who believe in the candidate. You know, one of the reasons the checkoff has a big problem, in addition to the fact that people don't like the idea of their tax dollars being spent on elections, they know that their money could be spent on behalf of a candidate they don't agree with. You know, people prefer to support candidates that they like. And that's what the voluntary direct contribution to the candidate of your choice provides for you, the opportunity to give your money to a cause you believe in.
We have an email from Ed in Santa Rosa, California. He writes, Senator McConnell has said that money is speech, but since some have more money than others, would this mean they have a larger voice in the direction of our government? Isn't this inconsistent with the idea of one person, one vote?
Well, the Supreme Court has said that the expenditure of money is speech. That was Thurgood Marshall, and certainly not a conservative, who stated the obvious, that if you're not fortunate enough to own NPR, for example, It's hard to reach a larger audience. It requires the expenditure of money in order to amplify your voice to reach a larger audience. That's why money is essential in politics and not something that we should feel squeamish about, provided the donations are limited and disclosed. Everyone knows who's supporting everyone else. You simply must have money in politics. Otherwise, the candidates have no chance of getting their voices heard.
Would you at this point be in favor of writing a new law or repealing the old laws or just letting it creak to an end?
Oh, gosh, you know, I think the public is taking care of this issue on its own by choosing not to check off. The candidates are realizing that they can raise more money from people who support them, and they're opting out. I think this law is on the way to the ash heap of history, which is where it should be relegated.
Our next caller is Reggie, who joins us on the line from Tallahassee, Florida.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope I turned my radio off while I was on the line, so I hope that this has not already been answered. My question is if money is necessary for the candidates to get their message out and money is considered a part of our free speech, well, why is there spending caps that they even have to worry about?
Well, there are no spending caps. A candidate can spend as much as they want to in a campaign. There is a contribution limit, a limit on what an individual can give to another. Mm-hmm. But no limit on how many of those contributions the candidate can collect. And obviously, the more supporters you have, the louder voice you're going to have. And that makes a lot of sense. Candidates with a lot of support tend to do better than candidates with a little support.
Now, Reggie, you were trying to say...
I was just going to ask, so if they accept the public funding, though, they do have a cap, right?
They do, and that's why you see the candidates opting out. They've realized that they can get more support from people who are actually in favor of them, who want them to win, than they can by limiting their voices and accepting a public subsidy.
Okay.
Reggie, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Why don't we go now to, let me ask a question since, we can go with Jennifer. Jennifer's on the line with us from Chapel Hill.
Hi. I have so many things to say, but I originally called to respond to what an earlier caller said about which was also echoed a few seconds ago about Americans not caring about campaign finance reform and it simply not working. And I just wanted to point out that in both Maine and Arizona, on the state level, they have pretty successful campaign finance programs that have not only changed the face of those elections, but also increased voter participation in those states. And I think that's vital in a system that seems broken, where it appears, even if it's not the case, which, you know, sometimes I believe it is, but it appears that big money and special interests have a much larger voice than the average American over the kind of policy decisions that our politicians make once they're elected. And I have a question also for Mr. McConnell. If we get rid of campaign finance reform, or if it simply falls to the ashes, what would be put in place of that to make sure that people like me, I'm a student, have just as much a voice as someone who has billions of dollars or millions of dollars to contribute? I know there are contribution limits, but the point of my question is, how do we guarantee that we can fix the system that's obviously broken, where special interests have undue influence over policy?
Well, first of all, the system is not obviously broken. You neglected to mention the two states that have recently repealed taxpayer funding of elections, Massachusetts and Kentucky. There are two states continuing to experiment with it, Maine and Arizona. It, by the way, has no impact on turnout at all. In fact, the only thing that creates greater turnout is more spending, because as you would understand, the more advertising you see, the more visibility you see, the more likely you are to take an interest and to participate. The way that you prevent corruption is to have a limit on contributions, which we've had for 25 years, and full disclosure. And that way everybody knows who's supporting whom, and you can make an issue out of it in the campaign against your opponent. The newspapers can point out that you're being supported by A, B, and C, and that's not good. Limits on donations to candidates and full disclosure are the way you have a clean system, and that's what we have now.
Well,
Jennifer, just let me pause for a moment to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And go ahead. You had a follow-up?
I just wanted to say that I agree that disclosure is important, and I agree that spending limits are important. I don't think campaign finance reform in and of itself is a solution. It can't be an overarching solution, but I think it's an important part of that because not every American is going to be aware of who's getting contributions from where. You can look it up. It's you know, public information. You can find it online, but the average person, I don't think, takes the time to think about that kind of thing. But if you ask anybody on the street, they will tell you that they think that there is a problem between big money and campaigns and the kind of policy that our politicians are.
I know that they think that, but the truth is that's not a problem. You cannot contribute big money to a political candidate. You've not been able to do that for over a quarter of a century. And with regard to the issue of mandatory spending limits, the Supreme Court ruled that unconstitutional 25 years ago in a court dominated by the left. Thurgood Marshall held that way. William Brennan held that way. You simply cannot have a mandatory limit on how much speech a candidate in a free society may engage in. And that settled law has been settled law for over a quarter of a century.
Jennifer, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator McConnell, we just have a minute or so left with you. And as we mentioned earlier when we were talking with Congressman Meehan, we're expecting the Supreme Court decision on the soft money issue to come down in a couple of weeks' time. You have any inclinations? He thought his side was going to win on that.
Well, I'm the principal plaintiff in the case.
I understand that, yes.
The Federal Election Commission, we're hopeful. We had a good team of lawyers. Floyd Abrams, the most important First Amendment lawyer in America and very much on the liberal side of things, was the leader of my legal team. I think we made a good argument. We'll see. The court will decide within a month or so.
Will you hope to have you back on when the decision comes down?
Okay.
Senator Mitch McConnell, thanks very much for being with us today. Mitch McConnell is a Republican of Kentucky, and he spoke to us from Capitol Hill. Tom Mann is still with us from the Brookings Institution. And when we come back from a short break, we're going to take more of your calls on this question of how to finance campaign of presidents and the limits that are being opted out now by President Bush, by former Governor Howard Dean, and by Senator John Kerry. Is the system broken? Can it be fixed, or should it just be scrapped? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email at totn@npr.org. Also, the British royal family is getting a house guest this evening. We'll hear about the traditions and the rules of state visits to Britain. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation about the public financing of presidential campaigns with guest Thomas Mann of the Brookings Institution. And Tom wanted to ask an email question we got from Stephen Bottomley in Gainesville, Florida. How about a time limit rather than a spending cap on campaigning? Would that be an effective way to do it, shorten the election campaign a la California this last time around?
Oh, it's impossible to have a time limit unless you have a parliamentary system when elections aren't fixed. Because, in fact, candidates will always begin the process earlier and earlier. It's not the formal time, it's the informal incentive. So as much as we would like this to happen, it can't unless we change our basic structure of government. Neil, let me say that you asked the question, is the nominating system, the public financing system broken? The answer is yes, in the nominating phase, not the general. Can it be fixed? Yes. There is a bipartisan report out of the Campaign Finance Institute that would make changes in this system that would render it much more attractive to candidates to opt in for the nomination, and if an opponent opts out, would allow that candidate to compete without the spending limits. So the answer is it can be fixed. It worked very well for decades. There are ways of increasing the checkoff participation rate as well with a little public education campaign. Virtually every democracy in the world has some kind of public subsidies. I suspect that this isn't going to just fade away, that Americans may, in some situations, not like the idea of financing campaigns. The prospect of the alternative, returning to a state of nature in which everyone scrambles for money all the time, is not something they will find appealing as an alternative.
Let's get one more caller in on this point, and Lenny's on the line with us from Scottsdale, Arizona.
Hi there. I just think one way to deal with the campaign finance problems is just simply have term limits. The president gets 6 years, that's it. Don't look back, don't get reelected, don't bore us with the third elections, with a waste of time and money, TV, and then the whole ball of wax. Power corrupts. These guys, both presidents and senators, are in for too long, and we need to have someone that will start speaking up and give us the true scoop.
Lenny's not the first to make that suggestion, Thomas Mann.
Oh, Lenny, James Madison would be disappointed in you. The whole design of our constitutional system is to channel the natural ambitions of politicians to serve broader public purposes. If you don't have the chance of re-election, you have no reason for any elected official to be accountable to the public, to listen to the public. We now have experience with term limits in states, and the early findings are very, very depressing. The inexperience of the elected officials is driving power to the lobbyists and the permanent staff. Look at California. You like California? That's what term limits gave us in many respects. It
except
sounds good.
Except when Gray didn't perform, they kicked his butt out.
That was a recall election.
And why not have that in place?
Oh, there's another solution. Sort of forget any time a politician, let's say Gray was acting in a way that was responsible but unpopular, he was elected to serve a full term. If the fear of being deposed at any time is there through a recall election, it means we will have nothing but cowards serving in elective office. You've got to have more faith in small d democracy and the electoral process and democratic accountability, and not imagine you can isolate policymakers from the rough and tumble world of elections. That's what democracy is all about.
The only thing I fear is that power corrupts, and I'm not happy with someone like Strom Thurmond in power for 40 years. I just don't see that it serves us, but I appreciate your statements.
Lenny, we appreciate your phone call. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
And Thomas Mann, thanks for joining us today, as always.
Happy to be with you, Neil.
Thomas Mann is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He joined us on the phone from Philadelphia.